Today we're coming to the fourth of the five vital qualities of the mind, the five spiritual faculties, sort of what the Buddha identified as imperative qualities of the human mind that, if cultivated, can take us all the way from our ordinary how we are, right up to the dizzy reaches of enlightenment and all that that means. So yes, so Monday we started off with faith, Shraddha. Tuesday, Vidyadhara explored energy, Virya, energy in pursuit of the good. Last night, Shraddha Siddhi talked about mindfulness, and tonight I'm talking about samadhi, or absorption, concentration. Samadhi is actually the word we translate as meditation in English. So that's what we're going to do. So I'm going to talk about it for a little bit. I'm not going to talk for that, hopefully not that long. I'll talk about it for a little bit. Then I'll just tell you a little story about the Buddha and it's how samadhi erupted in his search. Actually, maybe just turn up a little bit. So I was reminded, actually, Shraddha Siddhi was just talking about the Christmas retreat there, and I was just sitting on the desk, and I was reminded of my first, I first went on a Christmas retreat about 10 years ago. I was in my first year of university, and this was when I had my first experience of samadhi, of this meditative absorption that I'd actually never heard of. Yeah, I remember I was a very, very happy boy with a rather privileged, blessed kind of upbringing. And then I'd recently split up with my then girlfriend, and my parents had also decided to divorce, and just finished my first semester at Edinburgh, and was like, oh, you know, what to do for Christmas? And mum was like, well, you know, you still come back for a family Christmas. And I was like, yeah, right. I'd rather stay in my student digs than, you know, I thought it'd be a bit weird. So anyway, I'd already been practicing as a Buddhist on and off since my early teens. So I thought, oh, I'll do one of those things that they always used to go on about, those retreats. So I was Googled. Did I Google? Yes, I did Google. We had Google then. And I Googled retreat centres, and I got some place in the Trossachs called Dana Kosha, and went off for a 7-day retreat in Scotland. And yeah, ended up having probably the best Christmas I've ever had, actually. It was absolutely a transformative, eye-opening experience. One of the first, yeah, particularly the meditation spheres. I mean, I'd always found meditation, you know, like a good thing to do, and always trusted that it was, you know, did me well and was good for my relationships with others and da-da-da-da-da. But, yeah, in the context of being on retreat, I managed to kind of get what all these Buddhas have been talking about. You all right, guys? You all right? Yeah, so there I was in Scotland. And yeah, basically, when you meditate with, and when you stay with it, suddenly, this can happen straight off the bat, but you can suddenly drop into different states of mind, super conscious states of mind. You can uncover completely new kinds of consciousness. I was quite familiar with drugs and sex and well-being. You know, I was quite a happy guy. And then what I sort of discovered in the meditation was something else. Yeah, there's something else. Very, very exciting. Yeah, I can remember we'd been meditating in this little stone room, and there was the retreat center was next to a huge loch, which was almost frozen. So it was very, very heavy, very beautiful conditions. And I can remember getting very absorbed in my breath, coming out of the this little shrine hall in the evening, and I could see my breath in the coldness, yeah? And it was like I was breathing like clouds of breath, like my breath was everywhere. It was like, and I felt like, I can remember thinking I was like a dragon, and I could feel my breath coming in and going out. And I can remember the colours were vivid, like I'd never seen before. A bit like, you know, what you can, you know, sometimes on, you know, on mushrooms or something, when the colours get very, very vivid and your senses get very, very bright. Sort of like the best of that, but much more complete and whole, without any kind of jerky states of mind, and completely devoid of any anxiety or any suspicion. So very, very wholesome. And then what starts to happen is it's like the ordinary physics of your movement, of your world, go a bit funky, go a bit different. So I can remember walking up just behind the retreat center, up a little hill by a stream, looking at the colours, walking very, very slow. I can remember picking up moss and tasting it. and just feeling like I was on being dropped into another planet, you know, just sort of landed on this planet and everything was completely completely new. And then I can remember being at this sort of stream that was coming down the mountain and feeling so light and full of energy, feeling very powerful. It's another sort of characteristic of samadhi. You feel very, very powerful. I felt like I could jump across the river. I'm here to tell the tale. I didn't actually get there. But I can remember for a long time standing on the edge of this large river thinking, I think people just don't do this because they don't know that you can do this. anyway, I think one of the other retreatants saw me standing on the edge of this and sort of called up to me. It's like, you're right there, pal. I was like, I'm better than ever. Yeah. Anyway, It was a very, 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 very exciting experience, yeah. So there is this whole, it's really important to remember, in a way we sort of, I don't know how much we sort of talk about it that much, because it's certainly very hard to discover, get into, well, I find it quite challenging to get into samadhi when I'm in the city. There's so much stimulation, it's very hard for the mind to really, really dwell down. You can do that, and people do that. There's people around here who do break through into super conscious states around here on a regular basis. But it is quite a bit harder in these conditions. It's one of the reasons why we always bang on about retreats, really, because this is so much easier. So this state of this samadhi is meditation proper. I mean, it's sort of sometimes it's easily described as a state of energized calm. That's where it starts. So we've probably all experienced something like this to some extent. I think it's fair enough to sort of imagine it as a sliding scale that goes from those states where you've been. You know, your states are heightened, that state of calm absorption where you're focused on one activity. Your mind isn't diffused, isn't distracted, isn't being interfered with and banging around with itself. It's wholly attending to one thing and you're fully absorbed in it. Your energies are alive and available to you and you can fully invest in whatever it is you want. And it's often accompanied, again, by this heightened sense of a vivid sense of life, focus, interest, joy, bliss, at a higher end, it also includes erotic energies that can also come online. You know, Stratosiddhi was talking about our teacher Sangharakshita, who famously once said, you know, meditation proper is like having sex inside yourself. I think he did say that, right? Yeah. just it's sort of pointing out the blissful side that can be reached, and how energies in the body are released and made much more available. All this in a highly skillful sphere. So samadhi is said to be what's weighty karma is said to be. Yeah, it's said to be weighty karma. Other kinds of weighty karma include things like killing people. That's negative weighty karma. Samadhi is supposed to be positive weighty karma. So it's a big deal. It's a very, very big deal. It's said to sort of give your whole being a really positive momentum. It's a very, very skillful state of mind to experience, and puts your being into real positive momentum. That's what karma is, in a way. It's sort of like momentum. Yeah. I guess the Buddhist emphasis on samadhi is, or the distinctive thing that Buddhism brought to samadhi. I mean, meditation is an ancient tradition, right? I mean, it goes back seems to go back well before the Buddha, like the Buddha to be learnt to meditate from other meditators, yeah? So it's an ancient tradition. And of course, it's, you know, all sorts of spiritual traditions use meditation, don't they? It's not a Buddhist thing. But it seems like the Buddha discovered something particular in meditation, which is maybe what we call samadhi. And it's particularly to do with this, it being incredibly skillful, positive state of mind, and it being a positive, skillful pleasure. Yeah? A very skillful kind of bliss. The Buddha-to-be, the young Gotama, was, you know, sort of a very, very ambitious seeker who went off looking for the best meditation teachers, trying to master the techniques of his time, looking for this mythical enlightenment. And lots of the traditions that he encountered were, or eventually he came into a very strong ascetic traditions and practices where people would really mortify the flesh. I mean, the kind of effort that these people were putting in to try and get to the truth, to understand thing, is like boggling. You know, like, you know, they'd sort of hang themselves upside down on a tree, like, all day. They'd, like, eat nothing. The Buddha fasted for so long that at one point he describes him being able to put his hand through his stomach and feel his spine. He also would meditate in intense heat. So they'd do this thing called the five fires, where they put fires around them and then have the sun at midday and meditate for a long time. And this is in India. So, like, crazy effort, yeah? Crazy intense effort to try and break through into the mythical enlightenment, which was sort of all the rage and what everyone was looking for. apparently, the whole community of people trying all sorts of things, trying to get there. Anyway, the Buddha sort of gave up, mastered all these techniques and became very respected, revered. This is the Buddha to be, yeah? And gave up because he said, they're still not it. People are revering me for these practices, but they're still not it. So the story says that he withdrew from that community, was sort of dismissed and disrespected for sort of giving up, and withdrew to the banks of a river. And then this is where samadhi comes in. This is where the first instance of sort of Buddhist samadhi comes in the way I'm thinking about it, at least. And it said the Buddha had a recollection of an experience, a natural experience he had as a boy. So the story goes is that the Buddha-to-be was sitting under a tree, an apple tree, And he spontaneously, he started to relax. He ate some food. He ate a little bit of rice milk, which his friends thought was very indulgent. And he relaxed. And in this relaxation, he had a vivid recollection of being a boy. And it seems like he was watching what's probably his father ploughing a field. Yeah, and he can remember that when that natural incident that occurred when he was a boy, he was thrown into a beautiful superconscious state of absorption, just watching his father plough the field. Very blissful, very beautiful, even perhaps maybe with, you know, if you're thinking of, you know, some empathy, some feeling for the motion of the plough, maybe some feeling for his father, even maybe a you know, some compassion for the effort. And if you've ever seen somebody ploughing a field, it's quite it's tough. And anyway, the Buddha remembered this incident as a boy, and then he seems to have said in the stories that have come down to us that he sort of happened on this other way of being, this other mode of being. He discovered another kind of consciousness, and then he starts to lean into it and goes, maybe this is the way to enlightenment. And then from there, through this episode, he moves into the experience which we come to describe as his full enlightenment. So, I'm just going to I'll tell you just the sort of what happens with that story in enlightenment, or how it's come down to. I'm just going to pause and just say one more thing about what one of the aspects of samadhi that. One of its key characteristics. So one of the things that's very, very emblematic of this state of mind is it's a state of integration. Yeah, it's when your energies start to come together, your energies, your psychophysical energies start to come completely together. Yeah, the Buddha compared it to soap powder and water. Apparently, when they used to, I've never seen anyone do this, but apparently, when you make soap, you mix powder with water until they're completely mixed one in the other. He compared that to what's happening with your psychophysical energy. So it's like your mind and your body are completely integrated. Yeah, I'm seeing some sort of, you know, mild nods. You can probably recognize this a little bit, you know, even from our experiences of doing mindfulness of breathing. Sometimes when you get absorbed in the breath, sometimes it's like you're no longer breathing, but it's just the body breathing. Sometimes even the breath starts to slightly disappear or sort of expand. Thought starts to fade away. And energies start to rise and brighten a little bit. And then you can often feel very, very comfortable. Sometimes you can feel like you could sit there for ages. Yeah. This is integration. This is moving into samadhi. So all the scattered parts of our mind, all the different aspects of our concerns, personalities, they start to... the ping pong mind, the sort of monkey mind, the ordinary mind that jumps around from one thing to the next, that starts to disappear, that starts to fade away, and your energies start to go fully aligned to the point where even your thoughts can fade away completely, so that there's no chatter at all. All hindrances are gone, so there's no irritation. There's no lurching craving, there's no tiredness, there's no slothfulness, that's all gone. You're just something else. You're something else, you're a different kind of person. Yet it also, so it's very sort of unfamiliar, and it also feels completely natural, and like, wow, this is who I really am. so It involves integration. Mindfulness of breathing is the meditation practice that is emblematic of this this integration, this important integration. But it also involves what we call vertical integration, the depths of our being. What we would these days call like our subconscious depths, and the dizzy heights of our being, our ideals, our visions. So it involves this angle as well, and that's just one way I want to think about it this evening, as I sort of reflecting on the Buddha's enlightenment, the Buddha's journey. So, and in this, you're also I also have to bring in tomorrow night. We're also going to be talking about wisdom or pranaya. And samadhi and pranaya are often talked about sort of together. It's partly one way to think about them. Pranaya is wisdom or penetrating insight, wisdom that sees into the truth of things, sees into the nature of reality. So Subhadramati will be talking about pranaya tomorrow. And I'm slightly going to be nudging into her talk a little bit, because samadhi is the foundation for pranaya to come. And they also sort of, pranaya can sort of also reinforce samadhi. One useful way to think about it is the soil. Samadhi, this state of energized calm, this fit state of mind, this integrated mind, is like really rich, healthy soil that we've turned over in our being. And then pranaya are like the seeds of insight when we bring reflections on the nature of reality into our meditation that can then grow. Full and strong, and enrich the soil further, and grow into something else. You can have insights without samadhi, without this kind of state of mind, but it's a bit like a seed dropping into soil that is dead, dry, arid. It can't really do anything. Quite a lot of people have this. They sort of have some kind of breakthrough and see something. But if the soil's not there, it can't take root. Samadhi, you could say, is a bit like the soil that we turn over of our being that we can then really grow from. So the Buddha's sitting under this, he's remembered this incident, sitting under the tree, this famous rose apple incident where he recollects a state of calm, of bliss, that he'd sort of forgotten, that comes back to him, and he's got this sense that this might be the way through, this might be the way to liberation. So he moves from here in this state of samadhi into his full enlightenment, into the full riches of pranaya. So the story goes that the Buddha, the first sort of stage of his enlightenment, is told in myth. It's told in the truth of myth, what happens, his journey. I mean, if you had a video camera and you had sort of had your video camera by the Bodhi tree in India 2,500 years ago, I don't think you would have seen this on the video camera, yeah? It's not like it didn't literally happen. The stories of enlightenment, because it's the mythic truths, deeper truths, you could even say, that are going on. So the Buddha meets some people, you could say. So first of all, the Buddha meets Mara. Mara is a demon in Buddhism. It's sort of like Buddhism's sort of devil. And Mara is sort of the personification, the demon that gets interested when we start to make progress. When we start to break through our ordinary consciousness into something more interesting, more profound, more true, Mara starts to try and stop us. That's when Mara shows up. Most of the time, this Mara figure doesn't really appear because he doesn't really have any work to do because we do it all for him. So the Buddha-to-be is just about to have a serious breakthrough into the truth of things. So Mara is in complete panic. So he does his full assault. And often in those of you who've been to Buddhist countries, this is one of the famous scenes that you'll often see depicted in Buddhist art. Cracking seem to to try and tackle in visions. So the Buddha's sitting under the Bodhi tree, the people tree, the old ficus religiosa, as I like to say when I get an opportunity. And Mara is assaulting him. So the first way he assaults him is Mara is another way to sort of, you know, sort of slightly boring way to think of Mara is he represents the forces of greed, hatred, and ignorance. So the first way he assaults Mara is he tries to seduce him. So the Buddha-to-be was a man, he seems to be a heterosexual man, so Mara sends him his daughters. A whole harem of daughters appear and try and seduce the Buddha away from his meditation, away from his quest. You can see why the artists like depicting these this scene. Anyway, the Buddha completely sees through it. He completely sees through it. He sees it all for what it is. He's not moved by it. He's not disgusted by it. He's not perturbed. He's just, he's completely invincible, you could say. And in the images, the seductive daughters of Mara turn into the other demons and disappear. So then Mara is completely desperate. So he throws his final assault at him, which is violence. So he assaults him with a full army, and in this one you have the famous sort of shower of arrows that Mara throws at the Buddha to try and scare him away from his quest. So he's introducing fear into the Buddha, saying, "You can't do this. I will attack you." And again, the Buddha is completely fearless, and the Buddha himself has no enmity for the aggression. He has no violent reaction towards this onslaught of demons. And you have the famous the arrows famously turn into flowers and fall around the Buddha, sort of representing the Buddha's the greater power of the Buddha's metta, or the Buddha's love. That's just like this force field which just turns all hatred into he just meets all hatred and turns it into compassion. And with that, Mara's completely defeated. In a final sort of assault to the Buddha, he approaches the Buddha himself. Mara confronts the Buddha himself and says, "What right do you have to sit here under this tree on sort of the mythical throne of enlightenment, the threshold of enlightenment? Who are you to attain enlightenment?" So he's testing the Buddha's resolve, testing the Buddha's faith in a way. And at this moment, the Buddha is said to put his hand down and touch the earth. Those of you who were here last night, do you remember the blue Buddha had the earth-touching mudra? That comes from this moment in the Buddha's story. And it said, the Buddha says, the earth is my witness that I have tried, I have struggled, I have made the effort to understand. The earth is my witness. And the earth goddess springs up, the earth goddess Dridhar, who's again depicted as a beautiful queen-like female, rises up out of the earth and says, "Yes, I testify, this man has done it. He's ready, he understands." And with that, Mara is defeated. And then the next thing that happens, I'm sort of, you know, jumping around a little bit about things I don't, mythical things I don't really understand, but, they're certainly very good for to keep reflecting on. The Buddha has an encounter with, after the Buddha's enlightenment, he's had this, he's had this huge revelation, a complete turning about in the deepest seat of his consciousness, where he's realized the truth of things. He's completely woken up to reality. And he's sort of processing, for want of a better word, this, unimaginable experience, unimaginable for us. And it said his mind turns toward, how on earth am I going to talk about this? How on earth is this communicable? Will anybody understand this at all? It's completely boggling, and yet it's the truth. I've discovered the truth of things, how things really are. And instead of that moment, he's starting to question whether he can actually communicate this. And then another figure appears in the story. This is a figure called Brahma Sahampati, who appears as an old man with a wizened beard. He's said to be one of the chieftains of the god realm. Was there in Buddhist cosmology. And he appears to the Buddha and entreats him to teach. He said, you must teach. There are beings in this world who have but little dust in their eyes. They will understand. You must try and communicate what you've understood. You must try and communicate the Dharma. With this entreaty, the Buddha finds the resolve to, yes, this can be communicated. I will find a way to share what I've discovered. So that's the appearance of Brahma Sahampati. All these episodes have got a lot there, you know, they're highly symbolic, highly mythical. They're very, very pregnant with meaning, and you can sort of reflect and interpret them in all sorts of ways. And I'm going to offer one sort of interpretation in a minute to do with what I was talking about at the beginning. The final character who comes into this episode is the King of the Serpents. So instead, after the Enlightenment, there was a huge, huge storm. Like an unbelievable storm. I mean, India has pretty intense rains and monsoons, but it said there was an incredible storm, and the Buddha was still sitting in enlightenment, still processing his experience, still in this deep state of samadhi, looking into the nature of reality and uncovering all sorts of things. His mind evanescing with insights into the nature of things, and it's said that the King of the Serpents, who apparently lives at the bottom of the ocean, crawled up onto the land. It's as if, like, nature itself was aware that something significant was happening, something revolutionary was happening in consciousness. Crawled up out of the depths of the ocean, highly symbolic, and found the Buddha, and coiled himself around the Buddha seven times and spread his huge cobra hood over the Buddha to protect him from the storm. Again, those of you who've been to Buddhist countries will often see this one, a man sitting inside an enormous snake meditating. This is the episode of the Muchalinda, the King of the Serpents. Again, you know, the symbolism of the serpent coming up from the depths of energy, transformative energy, nature, meeting the Buddha. All sorts of things. And then the Muchalinda stays there covering the Buddha, protecting him from the storm, so as not to disturb his profound meditation. And then eventually when the storm passes over, the snake uncoils, turns into a young prince, bows to the Buddha, and disappears. Yeah. So these are the mythical encounters. This is the mythical story of the Buddha's night of enlightenment. Sometimes it's a night, sometimes it's longer. It's sort of a slightly outside time. Obviously, it doesn't quite apply. But one of the ways that it's been interpreted, it's been appreciated. There's all sorts of ways you appreciate it. Was representing the myth of integration taken to its highest degree. So there's all sorts of ways of conceiving of the path, and one of them is to take this idea of integration all the way. It's not the only way, but it's one way. So just as you can have what we, so to speak, horizontal integration, the different elements of your mind and your life coming together to focus on one thing, you can also have this deep vertical integration that's sometimes going on. So, for instance, in this story, some of these figures can be appreciated to represent different aspects of archetypal significance, of different aspects of our psyche being uncovered, being discovered. Deep archetypes in human consciousness, sort of coming from, related to the work of great thinkers, spiritual men like Carl Jung, ideas of archetypes of the human mind. So, for instance, in this story, that some of you will be very familiar with this archetypal psychology, You can see how the characters sort of relate to these primordial patterns in the human mind, primordial personified energies or qualities in the human mind. The young boy, the beginning of the journey, representing the divine child in all of us, that quality of sort of naive sensitivity, wonder, fresh discovery that we all have in our mind. Mara, the sort of mythical shadow side of our minds, the side of our personalities that we don't really want to look at, the sides that the ignoble sides, all the anger, all the hatred, all the jealousy that we all know, we are all capable of, all that shadow sides of our personality that we we'd rather not. That side all comes to be integrated. All the energies in that side of our personality need to be brought onto the path, need to be transformed in our psyches. The Earth goddess Radar, classically, this is understood to be, in this case, the sort of sometimes it's called the anima, the feminine aspect of, in this case, the Buddha was the Buddha-to-be was a man. When he actually was enlightened, it said he transcended all of these notions, transcended even notions of gender in his enlightened mind. But the sacred female form appearing in his mind, and all the qualities associated with that. Brahma Sahampati, the old wise man, again the old man archetype, the wise and old man, who carries wisdom, the wisdom of helping, all the maturity. And then finally the Muchalinda, the great serpent, is said to, you know, can also be interpreted as representing the young hero, another key classic archetype appearing at the end of the Buddha's journey as he's about to then set out to do something. The young hero, the young sort of adolescent boy, as the prince, as saluting him. So, the reason why I just like that at the moment is partly a little bit to do with what Shraddha Siddhi was saying earlier. Like, it's not a what you're sort of dealing with in meditation and what we're looking for and what all this about is sort of uncovering deep natural truths. These truths, it's the truth that we're interested in. It's the truth of things. There's something about this interpretation I just heard there about the archetypes, which is like archetypes, you know, this is within all our minds. We can all resonate with these archetypes. We all have a connection and resonate to these forms. If any of you have ever been to a movie, all our movies, our culture is full of these archetypes, full of these archetypal figures. And they resonate with aspects of our own personality, our own psyches, and one way to consider the story of the Buddha's enlightenment, the traumatic story, is like the most sort of fantastic enactment of these archetypes coming together, meeting each other, and integrating to form another kind of being, a new kind of being, a Buddha. A new kind of discovery. And it's just so. Just want to finish actually with the Buddha on the shrine today. So you may on the Brahma retreat we've been. You have different Buddhas who are emblematic of different qualities. This evening on the shrine we have Amitabha, the Red Buddha. He's emblematic of, he's the sort of patron Buddha of samadhi, of meditation, absorption. His mudra is the meditation mudra. He's the Buddha is said to live in the low sun, in the red realm of the low sun. And his wisdom, all these Buddhas, he's a mythical Buddha, an archetypal Buddha. And his wisdom is said to be the wisdom of minute particularities. Or the wisdom of uniqueness. That in this state of, you know, he's in a, you know, an unbelievable state of samadhi, sees everything as unique. Because when you really see things as they are, given how impermanent, how insubstantial things are, everything's unique. Everything is completely unique. And it's said that Amitabha sees this. So you can sort of get a slight sense of this just as it's, as October draws in and coming into the centre, the light gets lower. And it you know, even in this time of year, the low light... So you get this underlight to our buildings in London, and suddenly, you know, you can find yourself cycling around a corner and just like, God, I've never, you know, oof, never seen, you know, things look, you really see the relief of some things and the particularities of some things, and it can be like blazingly beautiful, and it's sort of like quite unique because of the light, and you just, you know, so it's been a little bit in my mind in that sense, this low light, the sunset light of where, that's where Amitabha lives. And it's also to say that part of what we're trying to uncover through meditation practice, through our practice of samadhi, through our ongoing practice of uncovering samadhi, uncovering these kind of states of consciousness in our mind, and using them to look into the nature of reality, is you're sort of discovering who you really are. This is the other funny thing. This is another kind of model way of thinking about Buddhism, is you know, the discovery of a new kind of who, you know, the sort of quest to discover who you really are. Who are you? Who are you really? Not in a superficial sense. Most of us are fairly clear about that. Our CVs are probably pretty good. But in a much deeper sense of that questioning of, who actually am I? Whose mind is this? When I sit down to meditate, when I get absorbed, that feeling I had when I got into that first samadhi, which was completely unrecognizable. All my normal ordinariness, all my boring heaps of ordinary thought that I go round like a merry-go-round, all completely disappeared, and I was in a completely altered state. But it's felt so like natural, like a coming home, like a discovery, like an uncovery. So I think this is also a very important way to think about what's happening on the path, uncovering our deeper nature, discovering who we really are. And in a sense, we're not, we're probably not who exactly we think we are. And we're probably much, much more than we think we are. Well, that's what the Buddha certainly would insist on. We're much, much more than we think we are. And part of this whole thing is about uncovering, discovering who you really are, in a sense. And that will be, in a funny sense, unique. It's funny, as the sort of Buddhist teachers I look up to, the more and more progress they make on the path, the more and more loving they become, the more and more aware, the more and more sort of particular they are, the more and more sort of personality they seem to have. Not personality in that sort of barroom kind of he's a lad kind of personality, but like real interesting personality, like real individuality, yeah, real authentic ease and creativity and spontaneity, not part of, not reacting to, not part of any group, but different kind of person. Like all the aspects of their psyche, all the aspects of their being have been fully discovered, uncovered, or are being uncovered, and are all flowing into the same force for good in the world. All the energies, all the horizontal energies, all their skills, all their talents, all their best, and all their depths and all their heights are all coming together to impact the world and becoming a real force for good. Yeah, anyway, so I think I'll leave it there for this evening. And yes, Sir Bhadramati will be talking more. I hope I've sort of nudged in a little bit to the area of what seeing through to reality is about, what pranya, what wisdom is about. If samadhi is the soil, what kind of tree is it that can grow there? So she'll take us further tonight. We'll hear about that. Okay, thanks. Thanks very much. I think we'll leave it there. I've gone on a bit longer than I thought.